you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Life Hacker Podcast. It is January 23rd, and this week we are talking about Chrome extensions becoming malware, free alternatives to the now paid Log Me In, and life lessons from World of Warcraft. We're also answering your questions about organizing your iTunes library, streaming from a Chromecast, and buying a used MacBook Air. Let's get started. Hey everyone, and welcome to the show. I am Whitson Gordon.
I'm Adam Dotches.
And with us, we have Eric Ravenscraft joining us via Google Hangouts. What is up, Eric?
Not much, Whitson. What's up with you?
Nothing. So, Dotches is with us this week, even though he's technically on vacation.
Yeah.
Because he just can't stay away from the podcast.
Missed us. He sent us a really long email.
I did?
Talking about his feelings.
Oh, that must have been when I was 100% drunk and don't remember any of it.
I was going to say.
With all that drinking I do.
I know. When Dotches and I lived close to each other, he was always my designated driver because he never drank. It was awesome.
Yep. Not that you drank a lot either.
Right. Well, one beer, though, and I'm good to go.
Yeah, true.
All right. So we have a lot of really good news this week, and I'm really excited about some of our questions. So let's just jump right into it. The first, kind of the biggest story of the week was the Chrome extension gate. last week, Ars Technica had a story, and this week, that How2Geek had a slightly different story about a lot of formerly independent Chrome extensions, things like CRX Mouse, Smooth Gestures, and kind of other extensions like that we've featured on Lifehacker before. A lot of them are getting bought out by bigger companies for lots of money. And then these companies are basically injecting ad and in some cases, you know, tracking your entire browser history through all of these extensions. And it's what makes this really bad is that it's often done without the user's knowledge. So if, you know, if Lifehacker posted about this extension Smooth Gestures and I downloaded it and I use it every day, and then, you know, a year later, some company buys it and it starts injecting ads into all the sites that I visit, they can do that without the extension notifying me, you know, because the extension updates automatically. It might already have all of these permissions because Chrome's permissions are so broad in order to allow extensions to do their basic functionality that it also already has the permissions to spy on you or inject ads. And so a lot of people have been kind of caught off guard by this, and it's really, really annoying. And it's allowed by Google's like terms of service because they have a little blurb about it in the fine print in the description of their extension, which A, you know, a lot of people don't read, and B, is you don't see it if you had downloaded the extension before it got bought. So a lot of people are unaware of these things. Have you guys, I don't use Chrome, and I guess Firefox has this is a slightly smaller problem with Firefox. It's a much bigger problem for Chrome so far. Were either of you guys using some of these extensions?
I didn't use any of the ones that got infected. I did know,
I don't know if
a few
infected
people that
is really the right word. But yeah.
But it sounds dirty and I like it. But someone did intentionally infect it. Let's go
I
with
guess.
That. No, that's bad. but no, I know a few people who ditched HoverZoom.
HoverZoom was a great example.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Someone actually replaced HoverZoom with something else. And I'm trying to remember what the extension
was.
Yeah,
so there's some replacements coming out. And we've also heard from some of some extension developers that we like that have constantly gotten offers for lots of money for their extensions, like Honey. Dotches, I know you and I think both use Honey.
Oh, well, that's the coupon thing.
Yeah, it automatically adds coupon codes to everything you buy.
I can't remember which one I have active right now, but
I know
it's installed.
But Honey has gotten offered a ton of times to be bought out for stuff like this, and they've rejected it because they don't really want to be a part of this, and they'd rather make a really good extension themselves. At any rate, yeah. So the How2Geek has put together a list of extensions that they know of, and it's kind of a community effort. They're still working on it. So we'll put a link to all that in the show notes. There's also a Chrome extension called EXT Shield, that ironically you have to install it and it's an extension, but this one doesn't inject your sites with ads, and it will notify you if one of the other extensions you're using is, you know, known adware or spyware or whatever.
It's funny that this is happening now, because I was looking at the list of the extensions that have this problem, and I don't use any of them, but I do have an extension called Flash Video Downloader, which you can probably figure out what that does. And I think like 6 months ago, it added this thing that put little contextual advertisements for products on certain sites. And it was just, it was actually like supposed to be, I don't think it was supposed to, it was supposed to advertise anything in particular. It was actually supposed to be a helpful feature, but it had nothing to do with the extension. So it took me a while to figure out why this, where it was coming from, and what was causing these weird product pop-ups. I mean, not pop-ups, but like contextual links to products. Like you could peek in on an Amazon product page by just mousing over the link. It was really bizarre, and I was like, did Amazon do this? Because it's not happening on a different computer. So
right.
So I was really confused. Yeah, so it's a bizarre problem. I'm glad that it's being talked about, because I just thought it was that one extension, and I guess a lot of them are doing it.
And I kind of wish it had been talked about earlier, because a lot of this has been going on for a while.
Mm.
Ola Unblocker was one of the ones mentioned, but apparently they don't have ads anymore. That was something that they tested in December, and everyone stopped using them as a result. And so they took away the ads, but a lot of people haven't realized it. And they were in How To Geek's original list, but supposedly they don't have ads anymore, so they're good to use. But lately we've been recommending Proxmate, which is also a good option for watching blocked content overseas. So anyway, go to the show notes. There's some really good articles on the subject. We won't talk about it more here.
Yeah, we got more bad news to get to.
I know, more bad news. Log Me In is no longer free. The remote desktop tool that lets you access your computers from afar or help your less tech-savvy friends and relatives with their computer, it is no longer free. It is going to be officially only a paid app from now on. Yes, everyone's very sad. Luckily, there are still a lot of really great free alternatives. We've got a high five going on right now. With a list of free alternatives, by far my favorite is TeamViewer. I haven't used LogMeIn in years. TeamViewer is so easy to set up, and it works so well that I can't recommend it highly enough. Do either of you guys use LogMeIn or TeamViewer?
No.
I did use LogMeIn. not anymore.
So you're looking for an alternative.
There was one app, I think it was called RealVNC for Android, that just went free. It's, I think, in response to that news.
Probably.
I haven't tried it out yet, but I need something that runs on Windows, too.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, the Macs, I used to use RealVNC on Windows, and I guess whenever I have to install anything on Windows, VNC-wise, I've always used RealVNC. But on the Mac, the screen sharing is basically built in, and you turn it on.
Yeah.
So it's
and
not...
And with Back to My Mac and all that, if you have an all-Mac household, it's really easy.
Yeah, plus there's the screen sharing menulet plugin, which just puts all the computers in, and you can, if you don't want to use Back to My Mac because it's not always reliable, I have both of them on because I have that on, and then I also do port mapping on the router, so I just use whatever's working today.
Yeah.
And so that's really handy, but yeah, it's that's why I haven't really, I guess, messed with any of the other stuff. But sometimes there are those times when you like have to, I want to start using something that is easy to just set up really quickly for, like, when I have to tech support with my parents and have to get them to install something.
Yeah, I'm telling you, TeamViewer is insanely easy. And a lot of people get a little confused by it because it has so many different options when you first start. But if you just create an account with them, you'll say, I don't want to create an account, I want to use this thing instead. But their non-account version is way more confusing. Create an account, and you just log into that account on TeamViewer on any computer, and you can access all of your machines. It also has Wake on LAN support, which is really nice. So you can, you know, when I go to Michigan for, you know, the holidays or whatever, I put my computer here to sleep, and I can wake it up whenever I want to access it, and then put it back to sleep. It's amazing. So, anyway.
Awesome.
Check out our high five for all of the best options that's going on right now. Last piece of news is more of an announcement, but we have a new sub-blog at Lifehacker.
Adam.
We've been... So those of you who have been reading Lifehacker know that we kind of switched blogging platforms this year. We've got a new design, and we've got this new thing going called Kinja. And one of the cool things about it is that we can create these different sub-blogs that are, you know, something.lifehacker.com for specific subjects or different kinds of things. And for the past year, we've only really had Hackerspace, hackerspace.lifehacker.com, which is kind of a reader-run blog, which is really cool. But this week, we launched a new one called Lifehacker After Hours. You can find it at afterhours.lifehacker.com. And it is a place for all sorts of tips that we would never share on Lifehacker because they're just a little too controversial or not safe for work or just plain out there.
I would say never, though. There's probably some stuff.
Probably not never. Learn. Sometimes we sneak things in.
You got at least one on there.
Yeah, the thing is, Lifehacker's kind of always been this, we've always been a little bit more conservative with things like that. We try to be a very family-friendly, clean site, kind of.
I said pissed once in an article, and I got a complaint, to give you an idea.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I think we all like about the site, but it would also be nice if we could share some of these other tips about things that are part of life but are maybe just, you know, not everyone wants to read about. So if you go to afterhours.lifehacker.com, it's basically a separate blog with a separate RSS feed. We have a Twitter account at LHAfterHours. You can find all of those tips there, and if you never want to see them, you don't have to read the blog at all. Most of them won't show up on the Lifehacker front page. You know, every once in a while there's something that's borderline.
You don't have to read some stuff on the internet?
I know, it's shocking, right? If you don't like it, you just don't have to go. But the thing is, it's a sub-blog of Lifehacker, but its content doesn't show up on lifehacker.com. It's basically a separate blog, which is really nice. For those that kind of want that extra experience, they can get both. But those that don't want the extra experience can stick with the regular Lifehacker proper that they know and love.
Right. That's fantastic for the readers. It's not so good for us because all of our posts will show up on our profiles no matter what.
Yeah, I got an email
about
that.
Means my parents have to... Yeah, my parents have to censor the stuff that they show my grandpa.
I was definitely hoping that my parents didn't realize that this was going on, and my mom emailed me the day it happened and was like, "This is a great idea," and I was like, "Oh, that was surprising."
Yeah,
I'm glad you're supportive.
I
recommended, there was a post on, I think it's okay to say personal lubricant, and
yes.
And I recommended that one because it was the first one, and I was excited. I've been, as you both know, been pining for this sub blog for years, and so I recommended that post, and it shows up on my recommendations. So if someone's looking, like, I didn't even write it, but I got an email like, "Oh, you wrote this lubricant post. You might not want that to show up," even though that was Walter. But
yeah. I'm sure it'll be interesting in that sense. You know, you'll still may have to see a few headlines on the sidebar of some pages or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, nothing's going to come up on the Lifehacker front page. Nothing. You're not going to have pictures of anything, although we're going to try and keep the pictures mostly safe for work, too. We probably won't be talking about it much on the podcast. So those of you that prefer a clean podcast, we'll keep it that way for you.
Well, as clean as it usually is.
So we're going to need a separate after hours podcast.
Oh boy.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so that's there. I highly recommend checking it out. If you don't like it, you don't have to read it. Okay. I'm a little out of breath now. All that news. Let's move on to our top stories briefly. Eric, I want you to go first because your story was one of the most ridiculous stories I think we've ever written at Lifehacker. And I want you to tell us about it.
I talked about the real life lessons I learned from World of Warcraft. Which is not as ridiculous as
like,
it sounds.
Like how to live in your mom's basement and how to never talk to girls. And
you know what?
To...
I actually should have done some of those, try to slip those past you.
I'm obviously kidding. I used to play World of Warcraft too, so.
And you're the epitome of a ladies' man. That's the implication, right?
That wasn't really the implication. I was just saying sort of. I don't mean to insult World of Warcraft players because I consider myself a part of that community. I'm not a ladies man, but you know.
You're a lady man. You're just one.
That's true. I just have the one, so it's okay.
Yeah,
anyway,
so you're fine.
What kind of life lessons have you learned from the World of Warcraft, Eric? I can't say it with a straight face.
One of the lessons I learned. one of my favorite ones that was sometimes starting over is easier than you think, which like, it sounds like every time we like have to start something over, like change careers or move somewhere new, it sounds really overwhelming. And I know this sounds stupid, but like when I started over a new character, I'd already reached the level cap, and I start over a new character, I'm like, I don't want to have to go back to walking everywhere. But it was easier.
It was instead of riding my tiger.
Yes. Dude, I built a helicopter on one of my characters, and dude, then I had to go back to walking. So, but no, like it was easier because like I knew the ropes and I was more experienced. I wasn't alt-tabbing to the wiki every 5 minutes. And in real life, I did that too. I changed jobs a few years ago, and it took way less time to convince someone to pay me to write than it was to convince someone to pay me to edit videos. So
it's true. And a slightly different version of that tip that I know you and I briefly talked about that I learned from World of Warcraft is that sometimes if you don't do things right the first time, it's easier to start over from scratch than it is to try and continue on that path, whether you're working on like a DIY project or something like that. And I learned that my first World of Warcraft character, which was like a completely unbalanced character. All of the talents were poorly applied, and I was like, you know, I'm just going to start a new one, and it was a much better option. And so these kinds of things can translate to real life.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost like there's no such thing as starting completely over. You keep experience.
It's yeah, exactly. The real life experience points matter.
That's a much clever subhead. Why didn't I use that?
I know. Okay. Moving on. The other story that I thought was really interesting this week that I didn't really have any other place to put in the podcast, so I put it here. Backblaze, the cloud backup service, has been kind of doing these, collecting this data on hard drive reliability. And we might have talked about it once on the podcast before, but they recently released some more data talking about, you know, of all of their users, and these are home users, which brands of hard drives failed more often than others. And it is really funny to look at the results because basically Seagate failed a lot more than Hitachi and Western Digital. Part of this, I think, was because there was a group of kind of a faulty batch of 1.5 terabyte drives that went out.
Yeah.
But if you look at the graph, their 3 and 4 terabyte drives were still significantly higher than Hitachi's. Hitachi's had by far the best record. I was shocked about because I've never even bought a Hitachi drive.
Oh, I never realized that the Hitachi drives were good until I started opening up my Apple computers, the laptops generally.
Are they all Hitachis?
They hardly even use hard drives at all anymore, but they used to all be Hitachi, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know, that's not what I would have expected to find. And they were always very reliable. I never really had a hard drive die.
My first Apple hard drive was actually a Toshiba.
Oh, yeah. I have one of those, too.
I love that you have it there.
Right here.
I put it in an external enclosure, and this is from, like, 2006, and somehow it's still working.
Jeez.
It's definitely at the end of its life.
But I have a couple of those.
Anyway, so it's an interesting graph. I recommend checking it out. If you have Seagate drives, you know, you're probably okay, maybe, but keep them backed up, which goes for any drive. Just keep it backed up, and if it fails, then you'll know. And maybe next time you buy a drive, you'll look up some stats on which ones are more reliable, and you'll buy Hitachi.
Yeah. It's
or something.
It's just really low. Like, I've said this a million times on the podcast, I think. Well, probably about 8 if we're counting.
Are you going to talk about Seagate buying Maxter?
Yep. I just remember the days when Seagate was so reliable and it was just the way to go, and they bought Maxtor, and it was like they bought an infection.
Chrome extensions.
When is it going to end?
I would like to say, Dotches, this is just anecdotal evidence, but I had a Maxtor drive and it failed faster than any other drive I've ever owned. So now we have 2 pieces of completely useless anecdotal evidence.
I was going to say, it's not anecdotal evidence when it's your story.
No, hey, there's a sample size of 2.
I'm not saying
twice as high as 1.
I'm not saying this anecdotally. I'm saying, like, statistically, their reliability rates went down.
Yeah, so his evidence is better than yours.
Mine is actual evidence. I mean, I'm not citing it.
I doubled our sample size. I'm a stats miner. I know what I'm talking about.
But I do have anecdotal evidence of the Seagate problem, because I had about 4 drives fail on me. And I've never had a Western Digital drive fail.
Yeah, I guess I've been buying Western Digital and I haven't had a problem. So
yeah, and that's not to say they don't fail. They definitely fail. But
first of all hard drives fail.
Mm-hmm.
It's like saying you're going to die one day. Like, no matter, yes, you are going to die. It's just a matter of whether you're like 80 or whether then you're like 40.
Well, to everyone and everyone out there, I highly recommend going on Wikipedia or wherever else you want to go and reading about how hard drives work, because it just how everything works and how fragile it's like. It's kind of like the Earth. It's amazing that it doesn't fly off into, you know, the sun or something. That like the hard drive technology is so fragile that like a tiny little issue can just break the whole thing, and then yeah. And then your drive's dead. And it's just, I think it's just a really fascinating thing to read about, to think that we rely on this technology. It doesn't, like, how often hard drives don't die is what's amazing. It's amazing that every second your hard drive spins that it's not dead.
Yeah.
It's a wonder it works.
But the real lesson here is backup.
Yes.
I had a hard drive die this year and it was backed up, and so it was like the only thing it cost me was another $50 to buy another hard drive. All right, let's move on to our questions, because I think we have a pretty good batch of questions this week.
We do.
Cool. Kristen asks, I recently migrated my iTunes library to another hard drive on my Mac. I'm not sure how, but in the process, all of my music has become mixed up. The album art seems to be the only thing that is still correct. All of my songs have the wrong titles, the wrong albums, and the wrong artist names attached to them. Is there some way I can clean up the files without having to go through them all one by one? I have a fairly large library. Okay, first of all, I have no idea how this happened. This seems crazy to me.
Yeah, it does.
But luckily, there is a really easy solution. We'll put a link in the show notes to a guide we've done on kind of whipping your music metadata into shape. But by far the easiest thing and the most automatic, I would check out Music Brains Picard. That's Music Brains with a Z. and it should be able to look at your files, and even just looking at like the time codes and all that, even if you just filled in the album names, it should be able to fill in everything else automatically for you. You may have to kind of play with it a bit to get it to work, but it is awesome. I believe it's free.
I have a quick question. Is it Picard like Captain Picard?
It is. In fact, it is named after Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Good.
Of the USS Enterprise.
Good.
Fantastic.
And it works on Mac, Windows, and Linux. So I highly recommend it. It's been years since I've used it, but last time I remember it being pretty solid. There's also a paid app that uses the same database called Jaikaz, Jaikoz. And I remember it being a little easier to use.
Let's make it easy for everyone with all these applications.
I know.
Let's just mash some letters on the keyboard and call it an app.
Exactly. I remember Jaikaz being a little bit easier to use, but it costs $10. But it may be worth it if you have a large enough library and, you know. So that's what I would recommend, Kristen. Go check that out.
Make it so.
Someone nice. Had to say it.
Well done. All right. This one might be for you guys. Jonathan asks, I'm thinking about getting a Chromecast, but there seem to be a lot of other streaming devices out there. Is there a better alternative to the Chromecast, one that might offer more features like screen mirroring? Or is the Chromecast the way to go just because of its potential and because it bears the name Google? I'd be looking to use this for an Android smartphone, an Android tablet, and a PC.
I feel like the best reason to get a Chromecast is that you could just not eat for a day, and then you could buy a Chromecast with that money. It's so cheap that it's kind of like, why not? I mean, I have one that I don't use, which I guess the thing is, I mean, I don't generally recommend them to people, because what's the you know, if you're not going to use it, you're not going to use it. But I like things that have apps and are streaming apps and don't require another device to work. But the idea is really nice. I think probably at some point, I mean, Google likes to just play with all these things and make all these devices, and then eventually sometimes they pan out and sometimes they don't. And this is, you know, in the early stages, I think. But Eric, you have way more experience with the Chromecast than me, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like if you're asking about screen mirroring, then the Chromecast might not be for you, because it the only streaming of non-service or app-related things it does is tab casting, which is awful and you shouldn't use it anyway.
You mean screen casting your tablet?
Tab, a tablet in Chrome.
Oh, okay.
Like,
but that's still pretty solid, because a lot of what you do on your computer is in the browser.
Yes, so but it's awful. Only... No, but I don't mean that. No, yeah, it's very bad. It's choppy, and like I tried to do like a Hulu thing, and it crops down like just a portion of the window, not even the whole tab, just a portion of it, and it sort of depends on your Wi-Fi. It's just it's not a good experience when I tried it. So, in that sense, I mean, maybe it'll work better for you, but I didn't find it to be that useful. Outside of that, everything else is apps. It's Netflix, Hulu Plus, HBO, Vimeo. I think Vimeo has it now.
Sadly, not Amazon.
Not Amazon Video.
But hopefully one day?
I hope so. But Amazon keeps ignoring everything Google, which just seems bad for their...
I find it really interesting. It's like they're like, we're going to take Android. We're going to turn it into our own thing on our Kindle Fire platform. And then Google's not going to exist anymore.
So they've kind of got blinders on right now.
Yeah, they're like, oh no, we made the Android App Store. It doesn't, the real one, don't look. Just don't look at it.
Yeah. So, I mean, if what you're doing is you want to watch videos like Netflix or whatever, that's Chromecast is easily the best one if you're using, because he said he's using an Android smartphone and tablet. Mm-hmm. That's the best thing you can do.
And the cheapest.
Yes, also the cheapest. If you're using mixed company, you just want someone to use in your living room, a Roku might be better. But for screen mirroring and things, I don't know if there are good solutions for that yet, because the Chromecast isn't good for that. Would you say the Apple TV does?
If you have a Mac, Mac.
Oh, okay, right? Well, in that case, so...
So, yeah, in Jonathan's particular case, since he's using a Windows PC, Apple TV is not going to be useful. Well, but
so what's that Intel thing that I keep seeing this everywhere, and I never look into it because I just figure I'm never going to use it. But that there's some sort of, like, is it Wi-Dy, or is that something else? There's something
that's
where you
Wi-Fi can Direct.
What I can't remember. It's some sort of, like... Wi-Fi, but they named it something else.
Intel Wireless Display.
Oh, it might be.
Yeah.
Oh, that might be.
Yeah, wireless display. Yeah, where you can. Some laptops have something built in, so to speak. I don't know how built in it is. If it's, but anyway, there's.
I remember researching this, and I remember promptly forgetting it, which makes me think that it didn't really sound very good. But I can't say for certain.
It looked really complicated because when I saw it the first time, I'm like, oh, okay, I'll look into that. Because I think like the Western Digital box, the TV Live. Has it. Roku probably can do it. There are probably a lot of streaming boxes that can do it.
I don't know about the Roku. Oh. Well, anyway, let's back up for a second, because Jonathan's question really is, mm-hmm. I'd like a Chromecast. Is there something better that has more features that I should get instead? And I think that we can all agree that the answer is probably no.
Yeah.
Especially if you're using Android, and Windows.
Yeah.
In this case, a Chromecast is so cheap that... You know, a Roku or an Apple TV might be a good option, but they're going to be significantly more money than the Chromecast. And they won't offer, you know, like necessarily good screen mirroring features. They might have more channels, like the Roku has a ton of channels. So I would look into other streaming devices, but Chromecast is probably the best bang for your buck.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In terms of cost, it's for sure. I mean, there's really no harm in getting it. I mean, the thing is, you can also pick one up at Best Buy, and they have no restocking fee now. So you can try it out for 14 days and see if you hate it or not. And if you do, you can just take it back.
Yeah. Yep. It's
or not, because it's like you'll forget that you spent that money.
It's kind of a good backup. We've used it as a backup for stuff. Like if the TV, if the other things aren't working, like we can easily fire up the Chromecast with our iPads and watch Netflix.
This is the thing that drives me crazy about all of these, though. Because when I go on a trip, I like to take something with that has Plex available, so I can just stream TV or whatever from the house, or I can, you know, do Netflix or whatever. I like to have some sort of thing for the TV if I want to watch TV at some point. And the Chromecast is really—it's a really nice idea because you have this tiny little stick and you just plug it into the TV. And there are so many things, like they have, you know, like mini Android computers. So that's another option that we could talk about, where that's about $50, $60. You can get basically a smartphone / tablet without a screen that just plugs into HDMI. But all of these things are small, except you have to be able to power them. And sometimes you can power them with USB on the TV, and sometimes you can't. And if you don't know if you can do that in the hotel or apartment or wherever you're staying when you're traveling, or someone's house that you're just going over to,
you need to bring an actual plug with you.
Yeah, and so like it starts small, and then it just builds and builds up. And I found that bringing the Roku is actually just as efficient as anything else. It's
probably
one of
true.
Yeah, I have this tiny little case that's about, I would say eight by six, and it's and like 3 inches thick, and it is, and it holds the Roku and the remote and the adapter and a flash drive, and I probably could put some other stuff in there, but like I can fit all of that in, and it's very easy to take with me. So yeah, the Chromecast. I don't want to crap all over the Chromecast because it's definitely a really good cheap option, but in terms of traveling purposes,
I think overall the Roku is a better device. I agree with you.
Yeah, the Roku is a really great device that I wish more people would make games for, because it's actually well equipped for that. But that's a whole other story.
I would not have thought that about the Roku.
It's very capable, and
depending
on
which one you get,
the three,
there are so many different models.
Very capable.
Okay, and they all kind of get more expensive as you go up too, which mm-hmm. is, you know. So again, the Chromecast is best bang for your buck, but I think a Roku is overall a better device if you want to spend a little more money.
Yeah.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay, let's move on. Dotches, this question is definitely for you, because right. I don't think Eric and I know anything about this.
I know everything about this.
Cameron writes, I'm trying to plan a purchase of a MacBook Air. I've been saving a bit of money here and there and have about $600 or $700 ready and am waiting to pick up a used MacBook Air. However, I know very little about the inner workings of the Air. Are there models I should avoid? How old is too old to purchase? There are a few versions of the laptop from around 2010 that are selling for $500 or so. Are they worth it? What should I do to get myself a Mac that'll last a little bit but won't break the bank?
Okay, so the very simple answer to this question is there isn't really a model that's too old, but if you want to get, you know, a more modern computer that's good, there are two things. If you care about battery life, you have to get the most recent model. It's the only one that has crazy battery life, especially if you're talking about the 13-inch model, because it has the Haswell processors. You get a lot of battery life out of that. If you don't care that much about battery life, or you're willing to let that go, which I'm assuming you are if we're talking around $500 to $700, then just get one with a Core i processor. You should definitely be able to get that for under $700. That they haven't changed that much. You know, sometimes you'll get USB 3.0 you'll get that with some of the newer models. Other ones have, I guess, more storage space at a lower price point, but that's probably irrelevant in the used market.
Yeah. And I have to say, my MacBook Air from, I think, 2011 still gets great battery life.
Yeah, they're not, it's not like it's bad.
It's just that the new ones have the best, but he's buying a used one for, you know, $600 to $700. What year was it that they started making them with the Core i processors?
It was so there's the original MacBook Air that was just the overpriced crappy one. And then when they did the next iteration, which is what they look like now, that probably was 2010. Because it was, okay. It came out when I started working at Lifehacker, and that was 2010. And I remember Pash got one, and I think I got one. And they were, those were a little underpowered, and the graphics weren't that great. Well, so if we're gonna get into the little details of it, the things that really change, aside from USB 3.0 in the Core i models, are graphics. And so you have the original, which has a better graphics processor than the one that followed it. which is kind of weird because they went from an NVIDIA chip to the Intel built-in chip because Intel wouldn't allow the whole NVIDIA situation. It's a long story. So the first one, the first revision, which with the Core 2 Duo had good graphics, slower processor. The one that came after that had a faster processor, slower graphics. Then the third update, that's when they started getting a lot better. Then I think they added USB 3, then they added Haswell. And so the most recent one is really, really wonderful. But you'll be, I mean, if you're not, you're not really getting a MacBook Air for the graphics. So
no, it's true. It's just a matter of getting the ones that aren't like kind of really slow, which was before the Core i processors. I think the Core i processors did not come until the mid 2011.
That makes sense.
So I would try to shoot for the 2011 models rather than the 2010 models if you can.
Well, I think like it's worth even ignoring the year and just looking at the specs because because it's a lot of the times people, if you're looking on Craigslist and stuff, because I look at the used computers all the time, just, you know, just in case there's something that's a really good deal. If I'm bored and watching TV, I do that sometimes. And there's
they get the years wrong.
What?
They get the years wrong.
They get the years wrong. They don't put the year, and they put all these specs, and it's kind of confusing.
When you go to meet for the laptop, just go to About This Mac and see what kind of processor it has.
Yeah, it's just really, it's a, yeah, I think like the most important things are kind of what condition is the computer in? Does it have a Core i processor? Do you care about battery life? Do you care about USB 3.0? The graphics are going to be, you know, okay no matter what, but they're not going to be great. There's always, it's always integrated. So that, I mean, that's pretty much it. I won't worry about it too much. If it has a Core i processor, it's going to be fine, but do download or have them download. What is that battery program? It's like Coconut Battery or something.
That doesn't sound very reliable. You can look at the battery's health in the system.
Yeah. But this gives you,
but I think you're right. I think it's Coconut Battery.
Yeah. It gives you a really good idea of like how many charge cycles. Yeah, it is Coconut Battery. How many charge cycles have been done. You could just bring it on a flash drive and then just run it on there. It takes like 2 seconds. So I'd look at that. And then the other thing that tends to happen is, you know, like how clean they were. And this, I mean, this goes for any laptop, but the Apple keyboards can get really shiny and greasy feeling sometimes. So, you know,
but you can also clean that off pretty nicely with a Mr. Clean Magic Eraser. Mm-hmm. Thing is, magic, actually.
I mean, it helps us some, but the problem is once the coating on the keys wear away, you have to clean it more because they're just more prone to oil sticking to them.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to live questions.
Okay.
Because we've got some good ones.
Oh, goody.
Our top question is from Evan, who says, I recently inherited an old gaming PC from an in-law. It's a fairly old machine and needs a processor and RAM upgrade as well as a new hard drive. Do you know of any websites where I can check hardware compatibility? Okay, the first thing I would say is you probably won't be able to upgrade the processor unless you want to upgrade the motherboard, in which case you're going to have to upgrade most of the stuff inside the computer. Unless maybe it's an AMD build. The problem with processors is that they kind of iterate so fast and keep changing that sockets don't last for very long. Processor upgrades generally aren't worth it because you're only upgrading from one generation to the next, and you can't upgrade like, you know, five generations down the line because at least with Intel, they won't work on the same sockets. AMD builds, as from what I've seen, tend to keep their sockets a little bit longer, so that may work. As far as RAM and most hard drives should be compatible. You just need to check if it's SATA or IDE. Honestly, I would go to like Newegg and just try and see if you can find the motherboard. You know, you should have the motherboard model on the side of it. And if you look that up online anywhere, it should tell you what kinds of things are compatible with it. You know, what kind of RAM you need, what kind of processor will work. Can you guys think of anything else that I'm missing here? Is there a better way to do this? I think that's
as good
kind of the only thing you can do is Google the motherboard. The motherboard is going to determine pretty much everything as far as compatibility. So, good luck. You may or may not have any luck with the processor, and depending on how old it is, it might be kind of hard to find, you know, even like an upgraded video card for it. I thought my dad's old computer was going to be really upgradable, but it used like an AGP video card, which it's like really old. There's nothing modern really that you can upgrade that to. Anyway, William asks, what's the Chromecast bring to the table that the Roku 3 doesn't, besides price? I don't think anything. I think it's just price.
Yeah, I think we covered that, yeah, pretty thoroughly.
Yeah. Okay.
And the, yeah, the tab well, casting, well, if you care, but I wouldn't.
It's yeah, I mean, I think it's also that it's... I think it maybe brings a little bit more potential because the Roku has a more traditional app store, whereas Chromecast, you can just kind of build in support for it. I don't know how if Google's locking that development program down or not, but it just seems like if anyone wants to be involved in streaming something to Chromecast, they can make something that streams to Chromecast. Not that you can't make a Roku app, but this is all in my head, just for the record.
So,
but
this is not based on any sort of reality.
Well, actually, I've got some reality. Finish what you're saying, and then I'll go ahead.
Okay, it's based on what I've been experiencing with the Roku, and I the Roku's on my mind because I was just using it the other day when I was in San Francisco, and it was, it seems like it might be difficult for developers for some reason, or there's not. Or I guess migrating the apps that they've made for other app stores is the development process is more difficult because it doesn't seem to attract anyone, yet it's an extremely popular device with gaming support. So it's weird to me. Something's weird there why people aren't developing for Roku as much. Because there's a big opportunity.
The Roku's just never really gotten the love that it deserves, I feel like.
Yeah.
Where's the Chromecast? Kind of like, oh my God, Google made this thing. Ah.
Yeah.
You know, I was in a Best Buy before Christmas, and I just saw people looking at the Roku, and they're like, oh yeah, I heard about this. This is supposed to be really great. We should get one of these. It's a good deal. And it was a terrible deal. It was like $5 off. You get a much better deal online. I've learned my lesson about telling people that in the store because they just think you're weird.
The lesson was to do it more, right? As often as possible.
No. But it was. I think people are very aware of them. I don't know how many people own them, but it is a very popular streaming box. So I don't know. It's something. Maybe it doesn't get as much love as we think it deserves. But I think it gets enough that it's weird that there aren't more developers on it. It's really what I'd like the Apple TV to be in functionality.
Yeah,
not an interface.
It's the user experience is not as nice as the Apple TV.
Yeah, they're very slowly making the user experience a bit more tolerable. It's not horrible. It's just a lot more button presses than you need to press.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I do want to say one other thing about the Chromecast because I forgot about this earlier.
Go for it.
There is one other advantage of the Chromecast in that because the remote control is apps, developers can and occasionally do add extra functionality. So, for example, in the YouTube app, if you have four people over and they're all watching YouTube videos on the TV, you can... It's a tiny bit clunky, I think, the last time I tried this, but everyone can add YouTube videos to a shared playlist.
Yeah.
So...
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so everyone's on their phone, everyone sees the playlist, and he can put one in, you can put one in, change the order up. They could have changed the software since the last time I used it, but that's kind of a bit more potential that you have with Chromecast because the remote control itself is its own app, and it's built into the apps that the developers are already making. So,
yeah, it basically just—I mean, the whole Chromecast thing—it just adds a Chromecast button to an app.
Well, but that's the thing is that it doesn't. I mean, developers can choose to do more with it,
right? But what I'm saying is it's all built into the app rather than the.
Yeah,
which is nice that you don't have to have a controller. I mean, AirPlay works very similarly. Obviously, we're not dealing with you're dealing with Apple devices only in that situation. But like, it's nice to be able to. I think the Chromecast works a bit better because it's just kind of there. It's always just there. If you have a Chromecast in the vicinity, it shows up like it's supposed to. You don't have to really do a whole lot.
Yeah.
Whereas with AirPlay, you never really know what you're going to get.
Yeah, exactly. I'm more interested to see when Google finally releases the development kit so developers can, just anyone can make something for the Chromecast. Because you know that
so they haven't.
Yeah, no, it's only available right now to, like, certain companies come out with apps, but it's not okay. completely open right now. But
it seemed that way, but that's what I wasn't sure about.
Yeah, no,
so when that comes out, I think that's really going to make the Chromecast a lot better when people can just, when it's everywhere. It's weird that they haven't done that.
Yeah, it sort of is. And part of it is because like you can't just make an app for Android. It has to have a server component, and I think that's part of the weirdness with it.
But
I know once they open it up, you're going to see something like a turntable clone or something for your living room, which will be fantastic.
That would be, yeah.
Okay. Shiny Mango and Austin are both asking questions that have the same answer, kind of.
Okay.
The Shiny Mango's question is, do you guys know of a way to clean DVDs? And I assume he means like DVDs with scratches or stuff on them.
Winston, peanut butter. This is you. You, yeah.
And Austin's question is, can Adam play us something on his keyboard? Because he sees your little piano in the background. And the answer to both of those questions is, go watch the Media Center episode of the Life Hacker Show from a couple years ago.
I was like, how are those going to have the same answer?
Because not only do we test a bunch of different methods for cleaning DVDs, hint, toothpaste works really well, but also Adam plays a song on his keyboard about skipping ads on DVDs, and it's awesome.
That's amazing. So it's amazing you had something for both of those.
Same answer to both those questions. toothpaste works well for DVDs. Brasso, if you have Brasso, brass polish, that works really well too, right?
Yeah.
You were there when we did this.
Yeah, it's kind of a weird... I didn't think it... Yeah, it works.
Why did you think I knew about this? I don't remember doing this.
You were... Oh no! Because you put peanut butter in your seat, in your you cleaned a DVD with peanut butter with your brother.
I completely forgot about that. What? Oh my god, that's a great! I think that's still on Facebook. If you guys go to my Facebook and look for this video, it was like
I'm going to make a note on this podcast to link to the episode that you mentioned of the show, but also to link to your peanut butter video.
It was
in which
was
you
just
ruined
peanut butter.
Your DVD drive.
The problem was really toothpaste is the thing that works. But my brother saw this video online that was like toothpaste, peanut butter, Diet Coke, and baking soda. And I have no idea why all of these things were necessary because it's really just the toothpaste. But we decided to recreate this on a scratch DVD and I filmed it and it was absurd. And then I accidentally got peanut butter in my CD drive.
Yeah.
Because I didn't clean the disc off well enough when I put it in. So that was really cool. We have so many questions and we're never going to be able to get to them all, but there's one more that's, I think, a really easy answer. Kevin asks, do any of you listen to music on studio monitors? And both Dachis and I do. I don't know about you, Eric.
No.
But if we have, he's asked if we have recommendations or things to look for. My biggest recommendation is go listen to them. Guitar Center is not a place that I love, but Guitar Center has a big pro audio room with a ton of different studio monitors, and they will let you hook up your iPod and listen to as many as you want. And that is a great way to find a model that you like.
You got Yamahas, though. You got those Yamahas.
I did.
Right?
I got the Yamahas, and they were the ones I expected to like the least, and I liked them the most when I went and listened to them.
I have never heard them before. And
you should come over.
But I know. What's weird is I've been over several times, and I keep forgetting. But yeah. I don't know. I just had this feeling about them, and so I tell everyone to buy them, even though I've never listened to them. But I was right. I was right.
Yes.
I have like these super cheap Samson Resolve 65As, and I think they still make them, or they make like a newer version of them. I think they're about $150 a piece. You can probably get the ones I have. Mine are like 10 years old. They've always been so good. I've wanted to replace them, but I've had no reason to. Like, I've wanted to get the Yamahas because I know that they're awesome.
They're good.
But these are great. Every time I listen to music on the studio monitors, they're so good that I'm like, well, why would I buy anything?
Yeah, that's my second tip, is that once you go to Guitar Center or wherever and you listen to the monitors and you find a pair that you like, buy them used. Audio equipment is great. Buying audio equipment used is such a great idea because you always get a better deal, and it doesn't die out as easily. I got mine actually used from Guitar Center because I couldn't find them on Craigslist in my area, surprisingly.
They have a lot of good used stuff.
Yeah, and they have a lot, and you can buy. So I went to like the one here in Los Angeles, but when you buy stuff used, you don't just buy stuff that's in their store. There was a better deal on these particular speakers. Someone was selling them used in like Kansas or something. You know, a Guitar Center in Kansas had a pair that was, you know, these are, I think, $200 each, but I got them for like $100 each. from Ooh. Kansas. And so basically I was able to go to the computer with the sales guy and be like, I want this pair of used ones in Kansas that's cheaper than all the other ones because it has a minor defect like on the side or something, you know. And they shipped them over to the Guitar Center. They called me when they were in and I went to go pick them up and got an amazing deal. So try them out and buy them used are my two recommendations. Yes, you should do that. Take me with you. It's fun. All right. We should move on because the podcast has been going on for 50 minutes and we answered a lot of questions. We had some good ones. So Eric, why don't you start us off with your tip of the week?
I have a tip. Stop networking and start helping, which I think this was actually one of our guests' posts, wasn't it?
Possibly. Yeah, Jeff, I don't know. For some reason, when I read your tip, I thought you were talking about stop networking the computers in your house.
Oh,
I thought this was going to be like a Battlestar Galactica kind of thing.
No, no. And start helping your computers fend for themselves.
Yeah.
No.
I approve of this post. I think this is a very intelligent tip.
Yeah. Are you talking about the Battlestar Galactica thing or the actual post?
The actual post, but yeah. That would be funnier, so whatever you like.
Yeah. No, this one was talking about, I mean, I think it's less a specific tip and more a mentality change in approaching networking, which is like a lot of people have the idea like networking is go to a meeting and hand out your business card a lot and have 30-second chats with someone that you forget when you leave and that improves your career. No, it doesn't. That does nothing but talking to people, knowing what they need, helping out, just interacting with, like, having real conversations with people does a lot more for your career because you actually have relationships with these people. And like every time I see a networking post, it turns in like at the end, it always turns into, well, that's a really cynical way to approach it. No, it's not a cynical way to approach it. It's live your life like people matter and good things happen because you're investing in other people. It's not go deceive everyone into thinking you're helping, just go help them.
Yeah.
Genuine
connection is always better. It's harder.
Exactly.
But it's better.
Exactly. But you can choose to focus on that by not choosing to focus on shallow manipulative techniques. So,
yeah.
Cool. Thanks.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, my tip this week, and this is actually kind of an old tip for me, and this is kind of related to the studio monitor discussion we were just having, is how to properly set your subwoofer's volume in seconds without shaking the roof.
Why?
because it's horrible. This is the thing. I have been in so many people's cars or been to so many people's houses where they have these subwoofers that are just like cranked up because they think Moog bass is Beta bass,
yeah,
which is not at all true. And I say this as kind of a bass head. You know, obviously I think I like bass. I like dubstep. I listen to a lot of metal. You know, I love me some bass. But I learned through making this mistake myself that more bass is not better. And so the best way to tune your subwoofer so that it sounds good is to just turn it all the way down, turn on a song, like, you know, the music that you would normally listen to, and start turning up the subwoofer until you basically can just barely hear the subwoofer. You know, turn it up until you just hear it start to fill in the music and then stop and you're basically done. You can kind of do some extra tweaks, but that will get you 90% of the way and it takes like 5 seconds. And even if you are a bass head and you're listening to crazy dubstep and death metal and stuff, that is still going to sound better than cranking it up higher. It just will. You just got to give it a chance and you'll realize how much better it sounds and how much easier it is than this, like, some people, I assume some of my friends haven't even tweaked their subwoofer. They just plugged it in and let it go without even looking at the gain knob on the back, which is possibly even worse than turning it all the way up on purpose.
If I had done that, it wouldn't even be on.
Yeah, right? I had that problem when I moved into this apartment. I had the subwoofer hooked up on my speakers, and by the time I'd set up everything in my apartment, I had one power cable. And I was like, where does this go? My computer's plugged in. My speakers are plugged. I have so many cables. I'm like, okay, well, guess I just have this extra cable from something. 3 months later, realized my subwoofer was not plugged in to the wall. It was plugged into the stereo, but was getting no power, so I didn't have bass for like 3 months. But yeah, so anyway, there's a video from Parts Express that kind of shows how it's done, and it's a really good demonstration. And I think that if you try it, I've tried this on the three different subwoofers I own, and all of my stereos sound better than they used to.
I was curious. I didn't know what this tip was, and I was curious what you were going to say it was, because I when I do my subwoofer, I do what you said, except I touch the front of the speaker while the song's playing, mm-hmm. and I turn it up until I can feel it like in my throat chest area.
That's interesting.
And as soon as I feel it there, then I just turn it down a tiny bit. And for whatever reason, that's always gotten me the perfect amount of bass. As soon as I can feel it inside of me, that's too much.
Well, because you're not really supposed to hear the subwoofer. You're just supposed to kind of feel it a little bit. You mm-hmm. hear it fill out the sound, but you're not supposed to hear it go wub, 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 wub.
Yeah. And so it's good, because when I get to that point, if it's just beneath that, I don't need a ton of bass. I'm not one of those people who, I like bass, but I don't need it.
Don't like the Skrillex?
I still don't understand what Skrillex is, but I like when I'm watching TV or a movie or something, or listening to music in the living room where the subwoofer exists. That if my feet are on the ground, I can feel it a little bit more. So if I want more mm-hmm. bass, I just put my feet down, and then I can, and then it's more of an experience. But
it shouldn't drown out the rest of the sound.
No, it should. I feel like it should have an impact. It's like makeup, or as I understand it, that you don't want anyone to know you have it on.
Yes. That's actually beautiful. Is a pretty good analogy. That's exactly what subwoofers are like.
Oh, wow. That's fantastic.
I learned that from Bob
Saget.
We can
all go home now. The podcast just peaked.
On Full House, though. That's on Full House, they taught me about makeup. Because I think I forgot the older girl's name. The oldest daughter, she basically decided to go look like a hooker, and then learned that that's a bad idea. That you makeup's just to make you look your best, not to
make you look different.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh right, I have a tip.
That was basically your tip. You just gave us a bunch of tips. Feel the subwoofer until you feel it shake in your chest. It should be like makeup.
Yeah,
what other
welcome.
Possible tips could you have to share, Dachis?
Not one I posted about, actually, but one I discovered when I was I just drove up to San Francisco with my roommate on Sunday for the hell of it, and we went up for a couple of days, and just I don't know, because we wanted to, and we were in this situation where we had all these restaurants we wanted to eat at and not enough time to eat at all of them. And we wanted to try all these things and realized, why don't we just go to all of the restaurants in one evening, like a pub crawl, but for food? And
food
we would
crawl.
Just get like, yeah, a food crawl. And we would just get one item and split it, and then have little bits throughout the night. So this is where I can't imagine we're the first people to have thought of this. But we kind of, when we did, we were like, why have we not done this before? It was really amazing, because if you want to have an evening of something to do, and you're able to move around, if you're in a city where you can, you know, walk, or driving's not a big deal, then, you know, not Los Angeles, then you can just pick like three or four restaurants to go to, order small items, share them, sample them, and then move on to the next place. And you get to try everything. It's a really inexpensive way to eat. The restaurant gets confused because they don't understand why you're ordering practically nothing, but it's very, very cheap. It's cheaper than ordering a full meal, we found, and we did it twice, two nights in a row.
Interesting.
And yeah, and it's also and you also get like the right amount of food, because you're never ordering so much food that you're going to get this crazy portion and overeat it. So it's healthier, possibly. It can be healthier, it can be cheaper, and it
unless
also
you're doing
takes
a
like
tour of like deep fried food city.
Well, but I mean, we had the first night we had mostly like cheese and bread. And but we still had such small portions of it in total that it wasn't a big deal. And you also eat so slowly because you're moving from restaurant to restaurant that you don't, that it gives you time to realize that you're full. It also gives you time to potentially walk off the meal you just had. So there are a lot of benefits from it, and it takes up the whole night. It takes like three and a half hours. So it's an event, and it was just really a blast for us. So if you can do it in your own city, you can do it when you're on vacation. I just think like it's a really good way to make use of a night when you want to save some money, when you want to potentially eat healthier, when you want to try a bunch of things and you're limited on, you have limits or you don't, because it's fun. It's worth it for the fun part, but there are a lot of benefits too. So cool. Food crawl, give it a shot.
Yes, sir.
All right, downloads. Eric, go.
Yes, my download is Who Is On My Wi-Fi, which...
I think I can guess what it does.
It tells you who's on your Wi-Fi. Yeah. Yeah, no.
You guessed right, Eric, about your own download.
Yeah, as someone in the comments pointed out, you can do this on your own computer or on your own network if you log into your router, assuming that's something you have set up. I don't think I've ever logged into my router, and I should, but
you should.
A lot of people don't even know their router's like username and password, which is horrible,
because if they don't, someone else does.
Yeah, but also if you aren't on a network that you own.
Yeah, exactly. If you're in a public place on a hotel Wi-Fi or something, you can get on and see who's hogging the connection, which I guess if you're like troubleshooting someone else's network is useful. Personally, it's a bit like when someone cuts you off and you have to speed up and get next to them in traffic to see their face. Like you're not going to do anything about it, but you just need to see the person that wronged you. That's a bit like what this app is for me, is someone slowing down my connection and I want to know who's doing it.
If you don't know the username and password to your router, which you should, and you don't want to go through the trouble of looking it up, which you should.
Yeah.
So this is a really quick way to see if someone is on your Wi-Fi and shouldn't be.
Exactly. Yeah. So plus it's probably just a little bit easier because it's single focus. Yeah. So
it's just an app. And it's for Windows, right?
Exactly. Yes. For Windows.
Cool. Who Is On My Wi-Fi is the name of the app. My pick, it's very rare that I pick a Mac download on the podcast.
I was just thinking that.
But it's kind of a Windows download if you think about it really hard or don't think about it really hard. It's called Boot Champ, and it's for Macs running Boot Camp, which is what I do. I run Windows on my Mac using Boot Camp.
Oh, I just got that.
And I switch between them. So what Boot Champ does is it's just this little menu bar icon that helps you load into Windows from OS X really quickly. Usually when you boot up your computer, you have to press and hold the Option key and then choose Windows from the list. But if you just want to reboot straight into Windows, Boot Champ, you can just hit the Boot Champ icon in your menu bar, reboot into Windows, it'll take you straight there. The other option is using something like the Refit boot menu, which is pretty handy, but Boot Champ is an easy, quick little way to get into Windows from OS X.
Cool. That's my download is for also OS X, but is very OS X-y and is not a surprise. And it's called OpenEmu, and it's been around for a month or so now, I think.
And it helps you raise your emus?
Yes, it does. It's emus and alpacas.
I'm so good at guessing things today.
Yeah. It's actually one of the most beautiful emulation systems I've ever seen. And the Mac has really been ignored on the emulation front for so many years. It's wonderful to see such a great project in place. It's basically like, and I don't want to compare it to iTunes. It's like iTunes for emulation in that it's really nice and helps you organize your stuff. And is kind of straightforward and easy to use, but it doesn't suck in the ways iTunes does.
It's like the difference between iTunes and VLC. Instead of just being the program that loads the files, it's also a library of all of your games and stuff.
And it will down. Sense. It's not very good at it right now, but it will download the cover art for the games that you put in there.
That's cool.
If it fails, you can just add your own, which I did. But it essentially, you just add the games. It can even find the games on your hard drive for you. Ooh. and then it has cores in it for various systems. And right now they're a little old school. They're adding PS1 and N64 in the next release, I believe. But and you can download a beta version if you want to mess with it. But it's essentially a Just Works approach to emulation. You plug in pretty much any controller. I've yet to find a controller that does not work with it. Even I had a PS3 USB joystick thing that's like the size of the PS3 itself. And I thought it didn't work, and then I just realized I needed to restart the program because sometimes it doesn't recognize it until it boots up. But basically, it's wonderful for organization. It works great. The features are great. It looks beautiful. You just plug things in and go, and there's so little that more you could want out of this thing. So if you're on a Mac, it's a really fantastic way to play your favorite old games or homebrew or whatever you consider to be an ethical choice on your part.
I'm a little upset that it's not on Windows right now, to be honest.
I know. I actually was kind of bummed that it wasn't a cross-platform download because it's so wonderful. And one of the things that bugs me about Mac software a lot of the time is that people who develop Mac software, they're like, oh, okay, well, we don't need to develop for any other platform ever. And that, while Windows is generally less important to me because I don't interact with it as much as other operating systems, it's a big problem with, they might do an iPhone app, but they won't do a web app, and they won't do an Android app.
Yep.
And so you get a lot of very Apple-centric developers, but that said, if you are on a Mac and you do want a way to emulate, it's also one of the first ways to easily emulate Game Boy Advance. So
that has been one of Dotch's complaints for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need those.
Yeah,
though.
It's weird. It's like there are Game Boy Advance emulators for the Mac, but they're complicated or terminal based. So stupid. Anyway,
terminal based Emu. Game Boy emulator.
Oh man.
Well, you have to launch it.
Things just got really geeky up in here.
Yeah. What's this? It's like it's not the way when you want to play a game, you don't necessarily just want to launch it from the command line and configure the whole thing from the command line.
Unless you're playing a text-based adventure game.
Yeah. Of course. But I don't think they had any of those for the Game Boy Advance
because that's basically
I don't know. They had like what was it? Like a DJ emulator thing or something.
Did they?
Yeah. No, I knew a band that like their primary pitch was that one of their instruments was a Game Boy and it used like, it was like early Garage Band or something.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Well, that's OpenEmu.
OpenEmu.org
if you want.
It's not for raising emus on a farm.
Aww. No. Sorry. Can we have an emu hacker?
Unless after the emus are sleeping, you like to play Game Boy Advance. Okay. That's it for us today. We've now gone over an hour. Sorry, everyone. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please rate us on iTunes and leave us a review. Every once in a while, I go back and I look at the iTunes reviews, and it always makes me so happy because there are so many good reviews for us, and I kind of sometimes wonder why.
Don't you want to make Whitson happy?
Thank you guys for listening over the years and leaving reviews on iTunes if you've already done that. That helps us out a ton. If you want to keep up with all of these things that we talk about during the podcast throughout the week as we publish them on the site, I highly recommend following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. You can find us on Twitter at Lifehacker, at facebook.com/lifehacker, and at google.com/+lifehacker. You can also follow all of us individually, which is, interesting as well sometimes. And you can find
sometimes.
You can find our Twitter and Facebook accounts at lifehacker.com/about. I also recommend checking out our two sublogs, hackerspace.lifehacker.com and afterhours.lifehacker.com. And you can find them on Twitter also at hackerspaceblog and at @LHAfterHours. So get ready for some really fun, not safe for work hacks at After Hours.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of fun stuff on the way. You can find the show notes for this episode in the description of the podcast. You can find the show notes for this and every other episode at lifehacker.com/the show. The show notes now are going up at a different time, a little earlier in the day to coincide with our earlier podcast. The show notes should now go up at 1 p.m. Pacific time every Thursday after the show is done. So you can check that out soon. That's it for us. We will see you guys next week. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Later.
Woo. Okay, I'm stopping.